This week on TSR in the news, Lieutenant Governor Patrick is putting the kibosh on a bad gun control proposal. We've got one Republican secretly campaigning with Democrats for Speaker, and the city of Austin with its silliest idea yet. In our interview, we chat with Steve Steinlight of the Center for Immigration Studies to get the truth about immigration, and we'll close with a commentary on why you should beware the dreaded fake election. Welcome back, Patriots, to another week of Texas Scorecard Radio. I'm your host, Tony McDonald, coming to you from the 1836 studios. We get started with this week's news. Let me turn to Brandon Walton's Capitol Bureau Chief for Texas Scorecard. You're up with a big story this week. Sources saying that a Republican running for Speaker, kind of working behind the scenes to court Democrats to build a Democrat-Republican coalition for Speaker. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, so as we get closer to the 29th legislative session, the race for the Speaker of the Texas House is heating up. Sources inside the Capitol say that State Representative Drew Darby, this is a liberal Republican out of San Angelo, is mounting a behind-the-scenes campaign for Speaker of the House.
Yeah, so basically, sources out there saying this guy's running with a message. We've got to defend the House, kind of our clubbish atmosphere right in the House. We've got to defend the House against Governor Greg Abbott, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. These guys are the boogeyman. We've got to unite to stop them. Basically, trying to put the band back together.
Exactly, and to try to defeat conservative legislation. I mean, you look at last session alone, Representative Darby joined with Democrats to kill state spending limits. He voted against strengthening property tax reform. So he has been, opposed to the conservative agenda in the House for quite some time.
Yeah, so it was really interesting. One of the things you pointed out in the story is that Darby hasn't just been meeting privately or those kind of things. He's actually been seen out in public with Democrats.
Yeah, so recently, this summer he was spotted out at a community theater here in Austin with a couple of liberal Austin state representatives.
Gina Hinojosa.
Just rubbing elbows, yucking it up. And it leads a lot of credence to, we've talked about before in this program, but the idea of a coalition speaker, that is a speaker that has the support of basically all the Democrats and a minority of Republicans, being able to join together, take the gavel, and be able to defeat conservative legislation. This is what we've seen with Joe Strauss, and we've heard some Democrats say that this is their best hope for defeating conservative legislation, is get someone like Drew Darby in the speakership.
Yeah, so for those who might not be following along, they don't live and breathe Texas politics, we've had an incumbent speaker of the Texas House over the last decade, a very liberal Republican from San Antonio, who's leaving the office now. But this is what he did back in 2009, put a coalition together between Democrats and Republicans.
Right, exactly. And so ahead of this legislative session with the open speakers race out there, the Texas House Republican Caucus changed their rules so that they would nominate a unified Republican candidate for the Speaker of the House.
This is basically the way it's done in Congress.
Yes.
It's done in other states. It's done everywhere.
Yes.
Nowhere do Republicans say, well, let's just let the Democrats elect our speaker.
Exactly.
they elect a Republican speaker.
Exactly. But Darby so far has refused to sign that pledge.
Yeah. The parallel, just talk about this, the parallel in Congress or in the Senate would be, say, let's say you let Susan Collins go over and join with the Democrats to elect, Chuck Schumer. Is going to be the Senate majority leader because a couple of Republicans joined with the Democrats. That's what's really at stake here. So one of the issues with Darby, so he has not signed the pledge, was giving, reported about this earlier this year, giving donations to other Republicans who haven't signed the pledge.
Exactly.
What are we seeing here? Is he putting together a group?
You certainly look at the pieces, and it looks that way. We'll see more evidence of this, I think, as we get closer to the session.
Yeah. Well, I think keep your eye on it. Welcome. Look forward to having you back on to talk more about this, because I think this is going to continue developing as we get closer to the session. Thanks
Absolutely.
For your reporting. Next, let's turn to Kerry Cheshire with Texans for Fiscal Responsibility. Kerry, you did a little bit of coverage. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick throwing cold water on a proposal, legislative proposal, gun control proposal, that had Second Amendment rights advocates really kind of up in arms. Tell us a little bit about it.
That's right, Tony. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick has come out against red flag laws saying, I don't support this. A majority of the Texas Senate doesn't support this. And it really kind of takes it off the table for the next session.
Yeah. So tell listeners, what is a red flag law?
So a red flag law is, you know, one that is designed to take guns away from bad people. It's a well-intentioned law that really has some constitutional consequences. It could essentially, as it was proposed, allow a teacher to say this student is a danger to himself and others and ask a judge to take the student and or the parents' guns away.
Yeah, this is basically a pre-trial, pre-litigation, kind of one-off hearing in a court to seize firearms from a person because somebody else believes they're a threat to themselves or others. And frankly, if they are a threat to themselves and others, well then, you know, okay, that would be what the point would be about. But what if they're not, right? That's the due process concern. So Governor Abbott came out with a proposal to study this issue a few months ago. Tell us a little bit about his proposal, kind of some of the backlash we saw.
That's right, Tony. Governor Greg Abbott, after his roundtables, after the wake of the Santa Fe shooting, came out with a legislative proposal that said, hey, let's look at red flag laws that protect due process. The problem is Democrats came out and said he's supporting our bill, which was actually very pernicious, and the NRA testified against it. It mirrored a proposal by Governor Cuomo in New York, and yeah, one that had been passed by Democrats. And it turns out you cannot pass a red flag law that protects due process. There's no way to wrangle that unicorn.
Yeah, it's a unicorn, basically. You know, people like the idea, hey, let's make sure that crazy people, you know, or violent people, dangerous people don't have firearms. But how do you know that unless you actually give them a trial? And if you give them a trial, you're taking a year and a half, 2 years to get to the end of that.
Right, and it's the due process considerations that really had Second Amendment activists up in arms over the proposals. And to give credit to Governor Abbott, he came out and said, look, there's a coalescence against this. I'm not for this. We're kind of done with this proposal now. And the legislature will go on and look at other things.
Yeah, so basically we've got the legislative leadership in Austin listening to the grassroots and saying, yeah, we wanted to study this issue. We've studied it, and we've decided it's not a very good idea.
Yeah, it's a very positive step. Gun rights activists have already notched a win before the legislature even convenes in January. Should be a positive sign of good things to come in the next session.
Yeah, still a few proposals in that package that I think we've talked about on the show that are of a concern to Second Amendment advocates, but it's good to see some of this bad stuff off the table. We'll have to keep tabs on what does move forward as we get closer to the legislative session.
Absolutely. Thanks, Tony.
Last, let's turn to Saurabh Sharma, intern here with Texas Scorecard. You were the first one to bring this to my attention. It's got a little national media sense, but you brought to my attention the city of Austin kind of consuming itself through its left-wing politics. They want to change the name.
That's right, Tony. So the Office of Equity that the city established in 2015 has barely done any work on the surface, but they just released this explosive report where they say that we need to change the name of a variety of Austin streets and monuments and such. And there's kind of obvious choices there that you'd expect the left to bring up, you know, places like Dixie Drive, Confederate Avenue, Plantation Road. But there's also a secondary list of places that they would also like to change the name of.
Including the place they're in, the city of Austin.
That's right. So Austin, named after Stephen F. Austin, is used not only as the city's name, but also for the rec center and a variety of other monuments.
For everything, right? Everything is Austin. It's the city of Austin, yeah. And so basically, you've got these left-wing politicos in Austin with the Equity Office, which I guess is the Office of Left-Wing Activism, tax-funded, of course. And they're going into this to say, let's purge every reference to anybody who has any connection with the Confederacy. Obviously, a lot of Southern heroes that things are named after, so it gets crazy. I mean, basically, I don't know if anybody in Austin would be able to find an address or find a business if they went through with this. They're changing pretty much all the names.
That's right. And some of the really famous streets in Austin that people are familiar with, you know, people across the country, places like Barton Springs or Burnett Road or Lamar Boulevard, you know, places we use to describe Austin, they're on this list as well.
Yeah, so you wouldn't be able to go to, you'd have to go to Barack Obama Springs and the city of Hillary or something if this. Kind of funny national media covering it, saying, oh, well, it makes sense. Stephen F. Austin was, of course, a Confederate general. We got a great laugh out of that. Of course, he died in 1836, 25 years before the Confederacy existed.
That's right, Tony. And just as a fun little thing, our CEO, Michael Quinn Sullivan, sent out a request to our members asking them what they think Austin should be renamed to if they decide they have to rename it. And some of the key choices were Snowflakeville, City McCity Face, if you're familiar with that on the internet. And my favorite is San Francisco. San Francisco.
Well, that's good. Thank you for your reporting on it, Sarab.
Of course, Tony. Thank you.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At texasscorecard.com or empowertexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's news digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at empowertexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
Well, it's my pleasure this week to welcome on the program Stephen Steinlight with the Center for Immigration Studies. Steve, you're in Texas speaking with Grassroots America, We the People, and glad that you could come on and share a little bit of your wisdom on immigration with our listeners.
Well, terrific. It's I've been to Tyler before. I've been to Grandview. I love East Texas. It's nice and green and watery, and nice. I've had great conversations with people here.
Yeah, well, and you know, this is a battleground, if you will, for the issue of immigration, for border security, for a lot of the negative effects we see related to illegal immigration, legal immigration as well. And your organization really a great resource for real data, real information about immigration, not just propaganda and rhetoric that we see out there from, you know, maybe business interests or from the left that's wanting to basically transform the nation. We have an entity here with the Center for Immigration Studies with real information. And so I wanted, you know, to talk a little bit about where we're at today, both from a policy standpoint, from a political standpoint. We know that Trump is serious about immigration reform, but the parties are not always so supportive. So what's really at stake? Let's talk a little bit about the data, because people maybe don't understand necessarily out there what really good immigration policy would look like.
Well, I mean, in terms of data, one thing that people should know is this country takes in, and you know, the left is continually saying, you know, America's ungenerous, and, you know, now they're screaming about fascism and Nazis and all this crazy stuff. America takes in every year more immigrants than the entire rest of the countries on the globe. We bring in legally about 1.2 million people, and we also get about 600,000 illegal immigrants. So we are taking in every year the equivalent of several American cities. I believe it's creating a population tsunami that's going to be very, very problematic for us. And, you know, people tend to focus also on illegal immigration, and quite rightly, and it's a violation of law. It troubles us.
That's right.
In a very special way. Legal immigration is a problem also, because the vast majority of the folks who come in, and it's not because they're not decent people or hardworking, the problem is that they really, for the most part, don't have the skills, job skills and education that are called for in a post-industrial, high-tech, knowledge-based society. Just the great majority of people, of course, up to very recently, have come to Mexico. In fact, Mexico so dominated the numbers that if you counted up the next 8 sending countries, it wouldn't equal the number from Mexico.
Wow.
And we were building kind of a second Mexican nation in the United States.
Right.
And now the shift has gone to Central America. And again, It's not that nobody works harder than Mexicans. It's not that they don't have a work ethic or that they're not good people. I never would say that.
But for the
most part, yes, of course, we can find, you know, every group, there's some crummy people. They're wonderful people, but the issue is that they're sort of on a broken escalator because the skills they are bringing are not the ones that are going to let them get up and make it into the middle class.
Well, the issue I saw in the 2016 elections with the election of Trump, him winning through the primary and then winning the general election and coming into office, to me it seems like there is this awareness of the American people that immigration policy is not for them. It is, in fact, a weapon, a tool used to fashion a different political electorate in this country that really puts the people who are in control of the government in America, you know, ostensibly now, could put them out of power permanently. And I think there's a perception and a reaction to that, that that's what the policies are aimed to achieve, not humanitarian purposes, not economic purposes, but political ends.
Yes. Tony, I think that's exactly right. I think, you know, that it's fair to say, and I think people who are not, you know, lunatics of the right or left, but let's kind of talk about sort of rational people somewhere toward a little bit toward the middle, recognize that what we have is an immigration policy that really no longer serves what we might call the national interest. And by national interest, I mean the greatest good for the greatest number of American people.
Right.
I don't mean for corporate greedy corporations who are willing to pay nothing to people, and I don't mean for the Democrat Party that wants to bring in ethnic demographics that it thinks will vote for them. I'm talking about what makes sense for the American people. And by the way, there were studies done. I just want to mention one thing, because so often people who talk about cutting immigration back or restricting it are labeled, of course, racists or fascists or some other thing. There was a very liberal sociologist at Boston University did a study about 8 years ago in which he focused on a lot of the culture issues, quote unquote, and it was a book called One Nation After All. And what he found was that American people, for example, I mean, he did study groups all over, and not just in border states, although, of course, he loaded it that way, but it was all over. American people are not bigoted about, say, Mexican immigrants at all. There is no discernible, no one's done statistics that show that there's any such attitude. First of all, Americans really get angry at illegal immigration.
Right.
Because Americans who come, you know, unless you come from a settler background or you're African American or you were brought here against your will or you're Native American, somewhere along the line, your family was an immigrant.
Yeah, so we have a passion and an appreciation for immigrants who, you know, do it the right way and then come here and have the success story. I think we always celebrate that, but that isn't necessarily what people perceive as going on.
Yeah, I mean, and the fact is, if anything, Americans are probably too pro-immigration given the economic realities. But I mean, what I'm saying is there's really no animus. In fact, immigration is cherished family history in this country.
Right.
And it's not about who it is. What Americans are troubled about is breaking the law. I mean, what Americans have figured out is we have a very diverse country with all kinds of folks, and if we're going to get along, people have to, like, not jump the queue, stay in line, obey the rules. That's how we could have social cohesion. And so when they see millions of people jumping the line, then they say that's the kind of thing that destroys, you know, the rule of law, destroys the rules of the game that let us have a civilized society.
Well, and even
it's
when
not about race. It's
yeah,
not,
well,
that's nonsense.
Even whenever you talk about the context of legal immigration, you look at our legal immigration system, and there's these systems that just don't make sense, taking too many legal immigrants from one country, such as Mexico, where you basically have less of a chance of assimilation, where you have this big bulk up of people, or you have other crazy stuff like the visa lottery. You know, you're just, oh, we're not going to make any kind of logical, you know, evaluation of who makes sense to be an immigrant. We're just going to hand it out willy-nilly in a lottery. And so it's been good to see President Trump saying, let's get rid of this nonsense.
Well, I think so much of what he's saying is very sensible. One reason is he took a lot of ideas from the Center for Immigration Studies. In fact, when he made that speech, we were the only outside organization he referenced. We have long argued that America really needs to have meritocratic criteria for people coming in. In other words, what can you bring the country? Do you have an? I don't mean that everyone has to have a PhD or be in high tech, but you know, are you a skilled carpenter? Are you a good mechanic? Are you someone who can contribute to the society at every level? You know, yes, nothing wrong with people with advanced degrees or wonderful people we're getting in nurses from the Philippines. I mean, these are fantastic folks, but what we've been doing essentially is just having a system of basically family nepotism. And, you know, you start out with, you know, your great uncle Juan came from your little village in Mexico.
Right.
And over the course of years, basically the whole village has migrated here. And we have had no role in choosing these folks. They're not coming because they have any particular skill or education. They're coming only because of a familial relationship. And that has to end. And the president's been very strong on that.
So let's talk a little bit, switch gears, and talk a little bit about policy there. But let's talk about politics and kind of the reality of the situation. You've got the Trump administration being as aggressive as we've seen any administration be on immigration reform in the right way, actually fixing the problems, not exacerbating them.
I'm glad you say that.
but you also have a Republican Party who is, you know, the party grassroots are very supportive, and some of the congressmen are supportive, but you certainly have all of these elements in the Congress that are, you know, not, you know, the rhinos. They're not really supportive of the Republican agenda. And so what are the chances here with the proposal for the wall and other immigration reform proposals that are coming from the president? What are we looking at politically?
Well, I would like to say that I have, you know, I'm confident. I would say that I'm cautiously optimistic that we're going to see some big changes. Congress is a real problem, and while it's very, very easy, and by the way, not incorrect, to target the Democrats, I would say, you know, the Democrats in this scenario are the devils. I mean, they are hell, but the Republicans are certainly not above purgatory. We've got the Republican leadership. This is very important to stress. I've been in this immigration battle. I joined CIS, so I'm coming up to 14 years. And I've been around for, I was around for the huge battle over comprehensive immigration reform back in 2007. We nearly lost America in 2007. There were two bills, 1348 and 1629, that would have, by the way, not only legalized the entire illegal population, it would have, can you believe this, doubled legal immigration.
Wow.
And the point is, and then, of course, in 2013, the Gang of Eight, their bills, same stuff. It's all the same stuff, always the same stuff. And the Republican leadership was on board with the Democrat leadership in the House and the Senate. So Republican Party, there's a huge divide, obviously, between, and we've been saved by House conservatives, the Freedom Caucus, and, you know, whatever incarnation happens to be of the conservative group in the House, they have saved us. And then finally, when, you know, we had actually, the vote came to the floor, say, in 2007, the American people really weighed in a gigantic, I remember at the height of that debate that Jeff Sessions, who was then a just wonderful senator from Alabama, announced that all communication media to the Capitol had crashed under the phone calls, you know, the emails, the texts being sent, telegrams, of course, we're going back a few years. And we started, I'll never forget that week. I was in Washington that week. The debate basically ran from a Tuesday to a Thursday. We started out, we only had 33 votes, nowhere near enough to stop Harry Reid from calling cloture and moving this horrendous legislation. By the end of that week, we had 56 votes, and it was enough. And you're going to love this because it talks about the cynicism of our political system. 12 Republicans and I think 8 Democrats switched sides.
Wow.
And what did we discover? We did a little afterwards study. What do these people have in common? They were all up for re-election in 2008.
Yeah, well, that's so ultimately the answer is people have to hold their public officials' feet to the fire. I mean, it goes back to engagement of the American public.
That's exactly right. You kind of count on the Republicans, but, you know, I wish I could clone, you know, the Louis Gohmerts and people like that. And it's hard. That's, you know, the issue is that, and what's so troubling is if you look at the data of, and this, I have a suggestion, by the way, for the president, but in any case, if you look at the data, particularly very recent data about what Americans think, they are really on our side. This is an issue that he should press, and that the Republicans shouldn't run away from. But my concern is that for many of them, they are so in bed with the Chamber of Commerce and American Manufacturing Associations that they're not going to disappoint their rich buddies.
I think, you know, the answer is the people need to speak up. But I think we're running out of time. Quickly, tell listeners, where can they learn more about your work at the Center for Immigration Studies? Where can they learn about the data that you all are putting out?
Oh, yes. We have a terrific website, and I urge folks to go there. And you just go to cis.org.
Thank you for the work you're doing. Thanks for calling in and joining us, and appreciate you coming down to Texas.
Tony, it's great. I love to talk. I can consider myself an honorary Texan. Thank you.
Great. Thanks.
God bless. Thank you very much. Bye.
Have you heard about the Texas Torchbearers program? It's a program that makes activism fun and exciting. You can sign up at texastorchbearers.com. There, you can learn about the easiest and most effective ways to engage your government officials in order to hold them accountable. As a Texas Torchbearer, you can earn cool prizes like an awesome pair of custom-fit cowboy boots with the Texas Torchbearer logo on it. As a promo, we gave away a beautiful custom-engraved Glock handgun. Sign up today at texastorchbearers.com. That's texastorchbearers with an S.com.
You've heard about fake news, but have you heard about fake elections? Michael Quinn Sullivan tells us more in this week's commentary.
In Texas, school districts are scheduling hastily called elections on odd days to push tax hikes through with minimal voter participation. This has to end, and 2 Republican lawmakers are vowing to make it a priority. With the Texas Scorecard Radio Commentary, I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan. Texas Scorecard's local bureau writers have been flooded with stories about school districts rushing to hold elections over the next few months, but avoiding the November election date. They really aren't hiding the reason. They want to minimize voter turnout. One school district is going so far as to have voting take place only at the schools themselves, where any voter who happens to get wind of the election will be treated to one-sided, tax-funded electioneering to achieve the school board's desired outcome. No dissent will be tolerated. Texas public schools are acting more like third-world banana republics than institutions under our Constitution. It's like Texas school administrators decided to replicate the voting systems of Soviet-era Russia. School boards are gaming the state's election code to raise taxes while claiming it was the will of the voters. In fact, each of these morally illegitimate exercises amount to little more than fake elections. It's appallingly indecent, reflecting the disrespect school administrators and board members have for local taxpayers. Fortunately, State Senator Paul Bettencourt of Houston wants to change this. Senator Bettencourt wants to change the law to prohibit the gaming of elections being undertaken by dishonest and greedy school boards. Texas Scorecard's Carrie Cheshire reports Senator Bettencourt plans to file legislation requiring that all property tax rate increase elections be held on a uniform election date in November. State Representative Mike Schofield has it exactly right. He recently said of school districts holding these off-calendar elections, quote, "If you have elections that few people know about, it's like you're trying to avoid the voters," end quote. Governor Greg Abbott and Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick should join Betancourt and Schofield in this fight and make ending these anti-American policies a legislative priority for 2019. With a Texas Scorecard Radio commentary, I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan.
Well, that's the end of the program. Adios, vaya con Dios, and join us back here next week for another episode of Texas Scorecard Radio.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.